The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 186.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to speaking with. He is a Bitcoin expert. His name is Robert Breedlove. Robert, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Hey, George. Glad to be here.
Okay, now, for those of my viewers, listeners, who might not know your full backstory, can you get us up to speed?
Yeah, I can give you the short version. I was educated as an accounting and finance degree. I've got a master's degree in both accounting and finance. Spent a number of years as a certified public accountant. I was doing entrepreneurial tax strategies for high net worth individuals and investment partnerships. I then, after discovering that career path was a bit too linear for me, I decided to get a little more adventurous. And I was pretty much a career CFO. Mostly focused in technology. And I had taken an interest to Bitcoin and crypto assets in 2014, but I did not have the epiphany or go down the rabbit hole, so to speak, until about 2016.
Okay.
That's when I started investing heavily into crypto assets. And then 2017 was, as most people remember, a pretty incredible year. Market was up 1,800%. In 12 months, and sort of as an organic sequence of that, everyone I knew close to me knew I was investing in the space, and we decided to get into the hedge fund business. In the past several years, we've been operating a multi-strategy crypto asset fund. They actually just got out of in 2020. And now I've been a lifelong reader, nerd, studier of economics and history. Through this process of falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it's given me an impetus to start writing and speaking about Bitcoin and history. And I've started to reorient my career more towards that. I think that's where my gift is. So I'm really trying to focus on being an ambassador for Bitcoin, which I think is an answer to the systemically broken legacy financial system.
So why don't we, if you're done there, why don't we go into your views, your kind of macro views, your views on the Fed, the government involvement that we've seen, especially the last year, but even leading up to that, and how does that fit into your Bitcoin thesis?
Yeah, it dovetails nicely, actually. So to that end, I've started this YouTube or podcast channel that I've called the What is Money Show. I found that macroeconomics tends to be an extremely complex domain, and it's quite difficult, I think, to convey a lot of these concepts simply. I don't know if you've seen the movie Inception.
Yeah.
Where they go into people's dreams and they're trying to incept an idea. I think this is actually kind of the key, is if you get people asking themselves the question, what is money, that they'll find their own path to the bottom of this rabbit hole. Where you'll find kind of answers to what is central banking, what is Bitcoin, why was gold money, et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of my macro views, and this is why I kicked myself for discovering Bitcoin in 2014, but not seeing the light until later. I had actually been studying central banking well before this. This is probably in 2005, 2006. I had read The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Oh, really?
Actually bought all of my family and friends an abridged version of that. Creature from Jekyll Island's Hughes, 500 or 600 page book. I bought for Christmas my family and friends a 100 page abridged version called Dishonest Money by Joe Plummer. And I had circulated this. And my curiosity had taken me to the bottom of central banking. And my thesis was that this was the root problem with so many socioeconomic issues in the world, is that we have a monopolized money supply that has given the government essentially perpetual access to the collective savings of society instead of being restricted to their own balance sheet, instead of being having accountability imposed upon them, they could run amok, essentially. So circulated this book. The few that read it got back to me and were like, you know, I thought I'd found the solution of the world here. It was like, hey, let's just rah-rah, let's go out and declare an end to central banking and everything will be better. The few that read the book got back to me and were like, this sounds great, but what do we do? Like, what is the specific action we can take to do this? Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that feeling of kind of general helplessness.
Right, right.
Because I thought I had found the answer here with knowledge, but knowledge is nothing unless backed by action. And I did not know the appropriate action to take at the time. So fast forward to 2014, I'm in Costa Rica on vacation, having an argument with a banker. And his position is that basically crypto assets will never happen. Banks and governments will never let it happen. And my position is the opposite, that they 100% will happen. But I just hadn't realized at that point that most of this wave of innovation coalesces to Bitcoin. So what we're looking at with Bitcoin, I guess, first of all, with central banking, is it is a institution that has festered around gold. Gold is the asset that the free market has selected as money for 5,000 years. And everyone understands gold is valuable. Very few understand why. And this is why I think it's so difficult to comprehend the value proposition of Bitcoin, is because you actually have to get to the first principles of money. And the first principles of money, in my view, in the Austrian economic view, are the five properties of money. That we can essentially think of money as the most tradable asset in any economy. And the market tends to select the asset that exhibits the greatest divisibility, durability, recognizability, portability, and scarcity. So I'll brush over some history here, but it was determined by the market that monetary metals best satisfied those five properties. And of the monetary metals, gold exhibited the highest scarcity. And you could quantify this with the stock to flow ratio, or said it differently, it was the monetary metal most resistant to supply inflation. Mm-hmm. So market actors knew that if they parked their wealth in this asset, they were least vulnerable to inflation over time. You can also think about this as least vulnerable to wealth misappropriation, right? They could trust the relative supply scarcity as a percentage of new flows annually, more so in gold than they could any other asset. So that made gold the best asset in the world for storing value across time, right? Because it exhibited the highest inflation resistance. The problem with metals, the big drawback they had, is that they're heavy and difficult to move across space. So this is actually what gave silver some marginal utility next to gold, because gold had very high value to weight ratio. It was typically used in larger transactions for final settlement. And this is actually where we get the term cash too. Cash implied final settlement of monetary metals. But since silver had a lower value to weight ratio, it was used alongside gold as more of a day-to-day transactional metal.
Right.
Until we figured out this warehousing business, where we could just warehouse the metals, abstract them into a warehouse receipt or a paper currency, and then transact in the paper bills themselves to increase the portability of metals across space. And that got us to the gold standard, more or less, right? These warehouses became banks, banks became central banks. The centralization over the custody kept increasing over time because there are greater economies of scale in using monetary metals as money, the larger the supply you have, essentially. So that got us to the gold standard. But as we've seen throughout history, and I'm sure you covered a lot with a lot of your audience, that introduced the problem of always needing to trust the custodian, which ultimately tended to become nationalized, or at least closely related to the government, who would quite often bend the rules to the point of even breaking contract law, such that they could lean on these warehousing operations or banks as a means of perpetually, as a source of perpetual credit for the government over time. So what we ended up with was supply of gold, gold receipts or warehouse receipts or bank notes printed in excess of that gold supply, repeated violations of the trust, basically, of market actors placed in warehousing operations. And the ultimate culmination of that was the 1971 Nixon shock, where we completely went off the gold standard and moved into this global fiat monetary system experiment, frankly, that we're 50 years into today. And that's it on a macro view. And then we could maybe drill down more into Bitcoin a bit later.
Yeah, I think to do that with Bitcoin, it would be helpful for the viewers if we get into a little bit of the nuance of the kind of the history, that timeline that you just went through. So in the United States, and I'm not sure how it worked elsewhere, but you start with full reserve banking, then you kind of move into free banking. And most people think, well, that's just where they don't charge anything. But that's actually when the government and the central bank was not involved. We didn't have a central bank. So the United States was like that, let's say in the early 1800s to the Civil War, when we kind of nationalized things, to your point. And you would go there, you'd give the gold to the bank, and then they would help hold it. And they'd give you basically bank notes that were printed by them, created by them, IOUs for the gold that you have. And we didn't see a lot of price inflation throughout the 1800s. From, if my memory serves me right, from the beginning of the 1800s to 1900, we saw prices of goods and services go down actually by 50%, which was a huge benefit to the average Joe, I would argue, because nominal wages actually went up, so did GDP during the same time frame. But my point there is the free market created fractional reserve banking. A lot of people, I think, believe that that was a byproduct of central banking or the government, and I don't think it was. So, and then in 1913, we went from kind of nationalizing the banks or a national banking system to a central banking system. And going right back to your point, then of course you get World War I right after that. And the government just goes to the Fed for the old piggy bank to buy those bonds and to give them the money they need to go and kill people. And right. You know, you can argue whether that was right or wrong, but that's kind of the way it panned out. And then, you know, maybe we went off the gold standard even in the 1930s when they confiscated gold. There's an argument for that. And then you go into Bretton Woods, 1944. And then you have just for the viewers there, the dollar is pegged to gold, and then other fiat currencies are pegged to the dollar. And then you have the euro dollar system that springs up as a result of that, again, by the free market, because the United States wasn't running high enough trade deficits and there weren't enough dollars getting outside of the United States. And so commercial banks and other economies that wanted to grow at full capacity started just creating their own dollars and their own IOUs. So that kind of is that kind of how you see things there?
Yeah, you do a great job of laying out a lot of history in a few words. I would start with kind of the beginning piece there is, you, to your point, fractional reserve banking, it does emerge even in a free market for banking. But here's the way to think about it is that banking as an operation, like it's not, you can't just perform all the functions of a bank for free, right? It's very expensive to have brick and mortar. You have to have the accounting, the warehousing, the custody, the security, et cetera. Banks tend to fund a lot of those operations by lending, right? So they'll actually produce what Mises would call fiduciary media.
Right.
This would be money not backed by gold reserves. So they actually have this fluctuating layer of credit on top of their core money supply. The original purpose of a bank were those two functions, actually, is they would custody real money, which would be monetary metals, and then they would loan out some of depositors' funds to what they deemed to be worthy, credit-worthy ventures, credit-worthy investors, right? So they were responsible for matching the timing of these deposits, which several of them would be time-locked, mm-hmm. with the the timing of these loans to entrepreneurs such that they were matching maturities so that they could actually generate an interest rate but still be able to satisfy the demand deposits for their depositors. And this is we've come a long way from that now, right? Where we think we have demand deposits in the bank today. And what's in fact happening is the bank is lending out 10x on top of that. So the dollars that you see in your online banking, for instance, they're really just IOUs. There's actually no money at all backing it because none of it's redeemable for gold. There's not even dollars backing it necessarily.
Right.
Modern age. So the problem comes so that's fine. Banks are free to go out and stake their reputation issuing this fiduciary media on top of their monetary reserve. But at any point, it's very binary for banks. If their customers lose faith in them, right, it only takes one sort of event, that bank, there can be a run on the bank. So they can get wiped out very quickly. So a bank has skin in the game, so to speak, and they have to maintain their reputation in the lending market. They have to be adequately assessing the creditworthiness of their borrowers and making sure they're performing that maturity matching function.
Yeah. And I'd add back then there was no moral hazards with bailouts.
That's right. Exactly. Because of this property, right? This is for the listeners that may have read Nassim Taleb, he has a great book called Skin in the Game. It's one of the main principles of his writing. Because they had skin in the game, right? They know it's their ass if they mismatch these maturities, or there's no lender of last resort in a free banking model. Let's just put it that way. It's you and you're responsible for your business. So we had this, and the American Constitution originally was designed to basically omit central banking because we had witnessed the evils of this institution in England prior. So and America indeed resisted two failed attempts of central bank implementation. And this is what generated, because we had this free banking, we had this deflation in the 18th century. So we had huge productivity gains accreting to free market actors. And this caused prices to come down a lot. This is what really was just a boon to the American economy as it was really getting started. And another way to think about this is that today, and you see this very distinctly after 1971, is the divergence of productivity and nominal wages. Mm. So what's happening in a central bank economy when you're printing new fiat currency is the central bank is actually harvesting that economic surplus of the productive economy. So in the 18th century, when that surplus is accreting to all actors in the form of price deflation, what we have today post 1971 is productivity surging, but all of that would-be price deflation is being harvested by the central bank,
right,
which is trying to generate positive price inflation no matter what, right? Because they have this debt-based system that requires more and more leverage to be sustainable over time.
Yeah, let me stop you right there just to make sure everyone's following what you're saying, because it's so important. And Schiff makes this point all the time. People say, oh, well, since 1981, we haven't seen much inflation. But yeah, even if you're keeping it at a constant, let's say 2%, what you're not seeing is the deflation we would have had as a result of increased productivity. And the deflation would have been in prices of the stuff you buy at Walmart, Target, Home Depot, whatever, going down annually as your income goes up in nominal terms. And that's exactly what we saw in the 1800s. So I want to make sure people are clear there, because they might say, well, in the 80s or not, you know, we didn't have much inflation. But that's not the point. The point is we didn't have the deflation we should have had.
That's right. You're absolutely correct. I would also argue, in addition to that, the actual definition of inflation we use is very skewed, which we can get to more later. But yeah, this is where it's tricky, because there was a lot of pain in these actually deflationary environments too, because nominal wages are coming down sometimes. Capitalists have to renegotiate the labor rates. But to your point, their real wages were increasing because costs of living were declining faster than wages.
Yeah, even nominal wages rose, as did nominal GDP. And the time frame I'm thinking of specifically is at the end of the Civil War, to about 1913. Now, prior to the Civil War, I'm not sure. I haven't seen any data on that. But now, go ahead.
I was talking more, not your time frame specifically, but more 20th century. There were a lot of tensions between like unions and capitalists.
Right.
They would have, because productivity was increasing so rapidly, actually the cost of labor was declining as well. So the point is, there's a great book on this called Economics in One Lesson. And this is, if you can learn to think in the seen versus the unseen.
Hazlitt.
Hazlitt. This is where people get tripped up. People that focus on the seen in the world of economics, I think, miss the true picture all the time. So it's not that, you know, even in today's terms, we have nominal house prices going up, portfolios going up, et cetera. But what's actually happening, the unseen, is the depreciation of the dollar. The economic frame of reference we're using to price all of these assets is what's declining. It's not so much that your house is becoming more, you know, valuable year over year. To get back to your historical arc, you made a great point that central banks, that was actually their original purpose, is to fund warfare. So we can think of, you know, the nation state as the dominant organizational mode that came to being in the 20th century. And it was in the competition among nation states, whoever could mobilize the most capital and people would win in war. And the central bank is that mechanism, right? So now, instead of just being limited to their own monetary reserves, as we said earlier, they can just print money until they collapse the entire currency, which enables them to essentially tap the entire savings of the whole society, being forced to use the currency.
Yeah, without the people voting on it.
Without people voting on it. So it's a key point. So it's a distortion of the voice of the people, which is a really important point to drill down on. And that gets us into Executive Order 6102, which you talked about, that the U.S. essentially had to outlaw gold, had to outlaw private gold ownership because it needed the money to fund war. And that too, as I've argued in some of my writing, is essentially a direct violation of freedom of speech. The tool that you choose to use, or the mechanism you use to communicate the language of value that is money, I think that's a very basic human right in a way, and to outlaw that is it's very antithetical to the free market capitalist paradigm that the United States was founded upon. So the idea of America, Executive Order 6102 we got away from that. We came away from the idea of America and started to be more of the nation that we are today. And then that, you know, post-war, we get into the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. So the U.S., North America had actually become a geographic safe haven for a lot of gold. You know, every time Germany would invade a country, their first stop would be the central bank. They would raid their gold hoards. So after seeing, I think, Poland and maybe one other country, a lot of European countries started to send their gold to North America as a safe haven. And near the end of the war, when enough of the gold was here, the U.S. entered the war, sort of finished off the war-wearied opponents, declared itself victorious, held the Bretton Woods Conference to rewrite the banking rules in its own favor, such that the U.S. dollar would be pegged to gold, all of the currencies would be pegged to the U.S. dollar. And that got us into that system, which ultimately broke down in 1971. Triven's dilemma, exactly. And then the euro dollar system emerged as well. And that's a very complex domain. I think if I had to sum it up, I would say it's the free market trying to work itself around the artifice created by central banks. So again, if we look historically, that money is a single purpose technology. It's just useful for moving value across time and space. It's the most tradable asset. It's valued based on its liquidity and network effects. So the market tends towards one, right? That's what gold was. Again, had gold been more portable in a trust minimized way, we wouldn't have had silver. And we actually saw that when we monetized to a gold standard, silver was largely demonetized as a result. So, but by virtue of central banks creating all these regulatory fiefdoms where they control their own currency, the market still had this pressure to seek a common, again, language of value or economic denominator. So it started to settle on, and plus the dollar's original position as redeemable for gold added to this network effect. So it's kind of piggybacking on the network effect of gold originally. And but because of these restrictions, a lot of these international markets couldn't access dollars directly. So they basically built a derivative system on top of a derivative system.
Right.
That is outside the control of the Fed. And the numbers, it's largely opaque and hard to determine, but I think at one point in Snyder's footnotes, the numbers were like over $16 trillion in the early 21st century, I want to say. That was just euro dollar money supply outside of control of the Fed. So the numbers get truly staggering.
Now,
and this, yeah. And it also adds...
Yeah, Friedman was even talking about the late 60s.
Yeah. The last point is that it just adds a lot of artificial demand for the dollar. So we have all these dollar-denominated debts worldwide, and there's just a huge hunger for dollars to satisfy those over time.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to figure out where to go from here. There's so many different directions. I would assume that part of your argument for Bitcoin being superior to gold would be the portability. Is that correct to assume? And therefore, you're taking a lot of the power away from the banking system because you don't necessarily have to put your Bitcoin in a bank. You don't have to have that custodian.
I think it's a great place to start. And that is one of the most important aspects of Bitcoin over gold. But actually, if you look at all five monetary properties, Bitcoin is superior. And again, as I've argued in much of my writing, it's almost perfected them. So in terms of divisibility, Bitcoin is divisible into 100 million units called Satoshis or Sats. Should its market cap reach a point that further divisibility is warranted, you can have a soft fork to increase the divisibility even further. So it's pretty much perfectly divisible. In terms of durability, Bitcoin is just pure digital information. So the entire Bitcoin history is stored on every node and miner worldwide. And information stored in a distributed fashion is pretty much the most immortal thing humans can create. And the example I like to give here is something like the Bible. All right, it's a book that's been in print for thousands of years. It's just information stored in a distributed format. And it's a book that outlasts empires for that reason. Right. In terms of recognizability, which refers to the auditability and the counterfeit resistance of a money, you know, if you're running your own node, Bitcoin is basically totally immune to counterfeit, and you can audit the global supply instantaneously at any time. This is a really important and unique feature of money. It also obfuscates the need for a lot of the institutional layers and framework we have today, which are built around, to your point, the lacking portability of gold. The reason we had all these financial institutions, the warehouse originally that we built layers and layers of institutions on top of, was because of the lacking portability of gold. If we just think hypothetically, had gold been dematerialized or made of pure information, could be beamed around the world at the speed of light, could be stored in your mind, stored in computer software, a book, anywhere information can be stored, we wouldn't have a need for these custodians. Right. Not to the same degree. Like I'm not saying that you wouldn't have them at all, but there wouldn't have been this opportunity to hijack the prime monetary network of the world, as we saw with gold. And that's what Bitcoin is, right? Again, pure digital information that's capable of doing all of those things I just laid out. And then finally, Bitcoin's really interesting because it is, as I've argued, a discovery, actually, and that we've discovered absolute scarcity. So gold historically, tends to inflate around 2% per year. We actually, as its market value has grown, we're actually increasing the amount of gold we're mining every year. But because gold is indestructible, its stock is growing as well. So it tends to work out to be around 2% inflation per year, which if we flip that, again, stock to flow is the inverse of the inflation rate. We'd say its stock to flow ratio is around 50 to 55. It's actually at 1.8% per year. So it's around 55.
I'm sorry to stop you. Can you just explain the stock to flow ratio for people who might not understand what you're referring to specifically? Because I think it's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I would point people to the book by Safety and Amous called The Bitcoin Standard on this topic. Stocks and flows are a very important, really a phenomenon for reality, but very important for economics and specifically commodities. And stock to flow, so it's stock over flow. Stock is the existing supply. Flow is a newly created supply over a time period, typically 1 year. The higher the stock to flow ratio, the harder the money or the harder the commodity. Another way of saying that, because we tend to think in inflation rate terms, is just the inverse of the inflation rate. So one divided by the inflation rate. If the inflation rate of gold for the past 50 years is 2%, one divided by 2% is 50. So with Bitcoin, we have the world's first algorithmically enforced and universally transparent stock to flow ratio. And it doubles every 4 years. So the Bitcoin built into the protocol is a halving. So it's actually contracting its new supply flow every 4 years, which means it's cutting its inflation rate in half and doubling its stock to flow ratio.
Right.
And there's work out there that you can argue about the model, but thus far in Bitcoin's 12-year history, its price has closely adhered to the stock to flow ratio. So the thesis being that every time the new supply flow is cut in half, which happens essentially overnight, the miners that are securing the network and being rewarded in Bitcoin, they're being rewarded half as much Bitcoin overnight. So we're at 1,800 Bitcoin per day pre-May 2020. We had the halving event in May 2020 that essentially overnight converts us to 900 Bitcoin mined per day. So this is cutting the selling pressure on Bitcoin in half instantaneously, really. It's actually in a 10-minute window from one block to the next.
Mm.
And this, so miners are being paid in Bitcoin and transaction fees, but at this point in Bitcoin's history, it's largely this block subsidy they're being paid in Bitcoin. And they're selling that Bitcoin to cover their operational expenditures. Bitcoin mining is a ruthlessly capitalistic space, very thin margin. So a lot of that Bitcoin is being sold to pay bills and fiat. When that selling pressure is reduced by 50% near instantaneously, the thesis is at least that if you're holding demand even constant, that you've now put a ton of upward pressure on the price by reducing the selling pressure of new supply.
Right.
So long short is, and we've seen that happen, Bitcoin, the price tends to appreciate rapidly 12 to 18 months, hitting a new peak 12 to 18 months after the halving. And so again, we had the halving in May 2020. We've seen a big run since then. I want to say the price was around 9,000, 8 or 9,000 at the halving. Clearly, we had this run up in January 2021 to a little over 40. And the thesis there is that that cycle repeats. So we have another halving in 2024. And today we have Bitcoin with a stock to flow ratio equal to gold, roughly. It's about 55 or 60. And then at the next halving event, we have the world's first asset ever with a stock to flow ratio double that of gold. And again, it keeps doubling every 4 years after that before reaching infinity when the last Bitcoin is mined in the year 2140. So with Bitcoin, we have something radically new. And this is where you get into the rabbit hole, because we have something that's as close to economic perfect information as we've ever had. Economic perfect information is an ideal state in economics where all market actors are fully informed and competing on a very pure basis, which in theory generates the most wealth and everything's arbitraged away. Now, you could never get to that point, but we now have a money that's composed of those principles. Like, everyone knows the supply, everyone knows the rules. It's a totally equitable playing field, essentially. And the other thing that's interesting is that you know, gold became money because it was relatively scarce, right? It was the most inflation-resistant asset. But in the digital domain with Bitcoin, we have the first instance of absolute scarcity. So if we could flip a switch and make everyone go mine gold today, we could get a lot more gold above ground much more quickly. It's just a function of how much time and energy we've allocated towards gold production. With Bitcoin, that's not the case. We could flip a switch right now and make everyone in the world go mine Bitcoin or turn their computers to go mine Bitcoin. The Bitcoin supply, the difficulty for the mining algorithm adjusts. It has a dynamic adjustment feature such that it always becomes more or less difficult based on free market inputs in a way that adheres perfectly to its fixed and diminishing supply schedule over time. Right. So we know with perfect information what the supply of Bitcoin is today and what it ever will be. Now, this gets super interesting when you consider that that supply curve maps really nicely, almost perfectly over its 12-year history to its price curve. Because if this pattern continues to hold, the incentives to front-run Bitcoin become enormous, right? Because if you the stock-to-flow pattern, it calls Bitcoin, has Bitcoin above $10 million by the year 2030, for instance. So, and this is where we get back to something Satoshi wrote originally, is that Bitcoin could become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that if enough people adopt it and it creates a market capitalization around itself, because it's following this pattern based on its supply curve that everyone can see all the way out until the year 2140, that it... It gets into your mind in a way like, wow, this thing could go to $10 million. So maybe I'll put 2, 5, 10% of my assets into it. But every time someone makes that decision, you're actually adding to the fulfillment of that price target.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds a little trippy, perhaps, but I would say that getting into Bitcoin is a bit that way.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You mentioned perfect money, and I agree with that. The one thing that I've said quite a few times, and maybe we can expand on this, is that we're imperfect creatures in an imperfect world. Therefore, we cannot expect perfect money to behave perfectly. Good. And on that note, I go back to kind of the fork that we were talking about with fractional reserve banking. And I've done a lot of thinking on this, and I thought, okay, well, what if we would have had Bitcoin then? Okay, so we wouldn't have had a need to put our Bitcoin into the bank. Therefore, they wouldn't have had fees or a need for fees. Therefore, they most likely would not have created additional IOUs or we'll call it currency units based on that gold or that Bitcoin. But then I go to a different thought process and say, okay, well, if you've got your Bitcoin, let's say it's at a level where it's not appreciating by 10% per day, you know, and it's a little more flat, and people are going to want to make a return, I would assume, on their mm-hmm. Bitcoin, and then it's going to end up in the hands of a fiduciary. Now, I totally agree that it's going to be far more decentralized, if we get to that point, but it's still in the hands of a fiduciary that will try to maximize a return. And they might be able to maximize that return by creating those same type of IOUs, as loans, as an example, that are backed by the Bitcoin. And I think, okay, well, some people that own Bitcoin would not want their Bitcoin to be lent out under those terms. They would say, okay, I prefer the full reserve system that Mises talked about. But I think a lot of people, especially the average Joe that really didn't understand the whole history of it, would say, yeah, for sure, I'll take the 7% return over the 3% return any day of the week, or I'll take that with a demand deposit, or the other one, you've got a time deposit, what have you. And then we kind of start going down the path of fractional reserve banking, or fractional reserve system, let's call it that, where we are creating more supply of Bitcoin, not the underlying asset, but IOUs that can be traded for goods and services, therefore potentially have the value of that Bitcoin go down to a degree in relation to those goods and services. So what are your thoughts on that? Am I totally crazy? Is there something there that I don't understand about Bitcoin, or what are your thoughts?
I think it's a great point, and we're back to, let's start with this. So with gold itself, we're very accustomed to thinking in the fiat paradigm that we need yield on everything, right? And yield implies risk, lending, et cetera.
Right.
But gold itself, if you're holding physical gold, you can think of that, or hard money in general, as that you've got a bearer asset, so you have no counterparty risk. You're effectively holding a non-counterparty index fund on global productivity or global equities, if you will, because so long as that money remains relatively scarce to the collective output of goods and services in the world, then your purchasing power is increasing year over year, right?
Going back to the 1800s, right.
Exactly. So that's the attractiveness of money, is that you have pure optionality on the aggregate productivity of the world. And if you're holding that money yourself, you have no, it's risk less or risk minimized, trust minimized, whatever you want to call it. The problem with gold, as we covered, like, it's expensive to secure, it's risky to hold physical gold, you know, someone can break in and take it, et cetera, et cetera. So there is an economic incentive to trust the warehouse operator to not only increase the transactability of your gold, but also to increase the security, give you peace of mind, et cetera.
Right.
But then you need to trust the warehouse operator, right? So what would this look like in a Bitcoin world? Clearly, self-custodying Bitcoin is much easier, right? It's just information. You can store it yourself, whatever. But with that power comes great responsibility. If you lose your private key, or you send Bitcoin to the wrong address, you make any of these irreversible mistakes, there is no one to call. You cannot call the big bank of Bitcoin and have them change your password.
Right. No customer service.
It is digital gold. It's a true digital bearer asset. If you screw up, it's on you. That is very intimidating to a lot of people. So I agree with you that there will still be banks in Bitcoin. Many people would prefer to abdicate that responsibility to a party or parties so that they can just have their comfortable experience of calling my guy, moving my money, whatever it may be. But Bitcoin too is interesting in that the custody around it is very unique. So there's something that's scarcely touched on today, but I think is going to be a really big deal in Bitcoin, called collaborative custody. So you can actually take the private key that is your Bitcoin, chop it into multiple pieces, and store each piece with a different custodian, or perhaps you hold a couple of the pieces, or your wife, or your lawyer, or your accountant, whatever. You can create these custom security schemas and key quorums, such that, say, you chopped it into five pieces, you need three of five to come together on these set terms that you've created to move funds. So this, And I think it's going to take a while, but I think the institutional world will move this way. That instead of just trusting Fidelity or JP Morgan, that will actually be trusting a quorum of asset custodians, because this enables custody without counterparty risk, or minimize counterparty risk. Like, you would need, instead of just needing to trust one, management group, you would actually need, you could trust that these three management groups won't collude to steal your funds. So you get more value for less risk, essentially. So I think that's one thing. The market will move that way. The other thing that we touched on earlier is that Bitcoin enables this cryptographic certainty. So even if I trust just one custodian, if I trusted them with my gold, they're just giving me a sheet of paper that says how much gold they have on deposit. I don't actually go and physically inspect the gold.
Right.
But with Bitcoin, there are tools that you can audit their supply. You can gain cryptographic certainty that they have the Bitcom that they say they have. If they're holding 10 of your Bitcoin, they can prove that. They can prove it every 10 minutes. So we've radically enhanced the auditability of the custody function in Bitcoin, even if you're using a centralized custodian model. And then you can do the same thing with collaborative custody, et cetera. But that still means, as we said earlier, again, banks were warehousing money, but they were issuing fiduciary media on top of that, which is essentially unbacked media of exchange. I think that's still possible in a Bitcoin standard. I think free banks will do that. But if we consider, too, that all these costs associated with fulfilling a banking function on a gold standard are much smaller on a Bitcoin standard for the reasons we've laid out, right? The bank is just more productive using these cryptographic tools. I would expect the positive correlation between the amount of fiduciary media issued and the cost structure of the bank, that should be much smaller. So I think debt overall will be a much smaller component of the world economy. And you'll have much smaller, I don't know how much, but it will be much smaller than the, 350% debt to GDP, pure fiduciary media world we're in today. It'll be more like 5% maybe of the money supply.
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry. One thing I want to point out there that I'm thinking of as you're saying that is Mises' argument when he was talking about fractional reserve or free banking. So that's fractional reserve without any government interference and without any central bank interference compared to full reserve. So he kind of went back and forth. He didn't mind. Well, I shouldn't say he didn't mind. He preferred full reserve banking because his argument, and a lot of people think that you can't lend in full reserve. You can absolutely lend in full reserve. Yep. It's, you've got that time deposit. And so you're not creating any additional IOUs, let's say. Based on the collateral that you have or whatever you're storing, whether it's Bitcoin or gold. So his argument was you wouldn't have a high amount of misallocated resources and malinvestment with full reserve banking. Now, I've talked to Snyder a lot about this, and he would argue that, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he would argue that if you don't have the flexibility for the money supply to increase with the demand for productive lending, then to a certain degree, it's going to stifle the growth of the domestic economy or that economy in particular. But I think Mises' argument was, well, although you may have more short-term growth, over the long run, it won't be as good because you'll have, by creating this fractional reserve system, you'll have more of a boom bust cycle, which misallocates resources, which over the long run would make society poorer, even though over the short one, you might get that little sugar boost. So if I'm going to take what you're saying and overlay that, yes, we might have fractional reserves, a system with Bitcoin, but it wouldn't be as much of a fractional reserve system. Therefore, it wouldn't be as much of a misallocation of resources. And maybe Mises would argue that it was superior, although maybe not as good as a full reserve system.
Correct on all points. I would say my general thought is that it's orders of magnitude smaller, could possibly go to zero. I think these banking operations in a Bitcoin economy will be, their operational expenditure will be very small relative to the existing system that has bank branches. You know, it's probably going to be digital banks largely. So these aren't going to have brick and mortar presence, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I would expect the fiduciary media to shrink alongside that cost profile. So it would be very small. The other point here that's very different than gold is that by customers having the option to withdraw their funds in full at any time or switch to another custodian instantly, right, with this digital money, this keeps banks very honest, and they can't gain the same level of government insulation as they have in the past, where governments would suspend payments, right? They would just cancel or close the gold window if there was a run on the bank, or that would, in theory, be much less enforceable or possible on a Bitcoin standard. And if you consider, too, these collaborative custody arrangements we've laid out, it may not be enforceable at all. If you're holding, you know, the bank's holding a few keys, you're holding a few keys, you're sort of halfway trusting the bank, but if things do get dodgy, you've got enough of a key quorum to withdraw your funds even against their will. This keeps banks honest. If they know that their customers have, what is it? When I was talking to Sailor the other day, he was saying that everyone in Miami Beach, a lot of people carry guns in Miami Beach, and this tends to make people really polite because you never know who's packing, right?
So, like Texas.
A bank is going to treat you really nice if they know you're holding the gun of you can fully withdraw your funds at any time and switch to a competitor, right? That's what a free market is based on, is that it forces businesses to be accountable to the preferences of their customer, because there's always the threat of competitive withdrawal or movement to a competitor. So I think you'll see more of that, in that banks will be treating their customers better because that option to move, the capital mobility is so high that it will force banks to be deliver a high level of customer satisfaction. And then to your last point, you know, I agree with Mises that hard money standard definitely enforces austerity in a lot of ways. So you probably don't get this. And I think the analogy is great, the sugar boost, because that's what it is. Debt is a drug in a way. We really do. It enables us to pull forward production in a way by creating a small illusion. You know, we're pumping out money that's not there in a way so we can mobilize ourselves over a short period. But over the long run, that economic acceleration has to be paid for by future sacrifice. So we can pay for later enjoyment with present sacrifice, that is saving, or we can pay for present enjoyment with future sacrifice, that is borrowing, essentially. And you can't fool economic reality, right? Someone has to make the stuff and provide the services ultimately. And I agree that saving is the right approach, and that will allocate capital, to Mises' points, more intelligently. We'll also develop longer and more sophisticated production cycles, because when we enter into these debt-based arrangements, we're actually shortening our time horizon, because we're like, well, the project has to get done, has to hit a certain hurdle rate, investors have to get paid back, and we have to get on to the next project. We're constantly trying to outpace this hurdle rate we call inflation or the interest rate, whatever it may be. But on a hard money society, a hard money standard, you're able to take a much longer view. And again, Safetyne's book, The Bitcoin Standard, goes into depth on this, how many of the 0-to-1 innovations were actually achieved on the gold standard in the late 19th century. Whereas in the 20th century, we saw a lot of one-to-many extensions of those innovations. So it's hard to say exactly, because we've never seen anything like this. Governments are always commandeering and monopolizing the money, so there's no clean, pure picture. But I think just thinking through it, that an economy more focused on savings would create more wealth and abundance for everyone.
We talked about the supply side of Bitcoin or gold, but I think a lot of people would push back with the demand component. And, mm-hmm. and because if we're, let's just talk about full reserve, whether it's gold or Bitcoin, because there you didn't have much elasticity mm-hmm. with the money supply, there could be all of these projects out there that could increase productivity. Because we talked about debt, but more so focus on consumer debt, where if you do have debt that's productive, where we're creating more goods and services with that debt, it isn't necessarily inflationary. In fact, it could be deflationary. So is there a way with an asset that's completely scarce to solve the problem of elasticity as well as scarcity? Do you have to choose one or the other?
Well, I think the free market has a mechanism built into this, built in for this as well. You know, if we consider Bitcoin is eating all the world's money, it is on a hard money standard. That Bitcoin now is no longer appreciating, you know, 100% year over year. It is appreciating in line with global productivity growth.
Right.
So it becomes your new hurdle rate. Whereas today our hurdle rate is the inflation rate. We need to be generating cash flows that outpace the inflation rate to be accretive to our business or our household. We now have this hurdle rate that's much lower, which would just be the general productivity growth that's accreting to that hard money. So say it's 2%, 3% per year. Now, all of a sudden, it may make sense to lend your Bitcoin to these projects that might, you know, that are predicting to return 5% or 7% per year. Whereas in a debt-based economy, that wouldn't be feasible, right? You're not going to, if money supply is inflating 15% a year, a project with a 7% expected internal rate of return is not going to get funded. Whereas on a gold standard, it might. So I don't know that the elasticity argument holds up for me. The other piece is that savings underpin investment, right? So today, the more savings we have, the larger the pool of that savings, and the less productivity is growing in the world, the lower that hurdle rate is, the more incentive there is to lend into the market for these projects that can improve the human condition, frankly. But if I think the interest rate becomes the mechanism that governs this, right? It's the supply and demand of money. So if there's a higher demand for money, the interest rate will increase such that it incentivizes savers to lend to projects. So I think that the natural interest rate is the answer. Again, we don't have a clear-cut picture or historical example of this because of all the manipulation in the market for money.
All right.
But the free market solves everything else. Why would it not solve this too? So I don't jive with the argument that we need elastic money or we need this debt relief. When things do contract economically, we need to paper over the losses with QE. Like, I don't think any of that is the answer. I think it actually exacerbates the problem, exacerbates the business cycle itself. And then I could jump into a few of the other demand drivers for Bitcoin. One, I think that is just very underappreciated is that, and we think about it like this, gold was energy money. What I mean by this is that any productive effort in the economy that couldn't be expected to increase productivity more than you could spend that same energy going to mine gold would just be allocated to mining gold effectively. So it became this floor for the allocation of human energy. And the other way to think about this, and I got this from my discussions with Saylor, is that you can think of money actually as the highest form of energy that humans can channel because it is a claim on all other productive efforts. So if we can make a nuclear plant and make nuclear energy, money's a claim on that. If we can tap into the earth and harness geothermal energy, money's a claim on that. If we can build a dam and generate hydroelectric energy, money is a claim on that. So money is this meta claim on any energy that humans can harness, if you will. So gold, again, the scarcity of gold was mapped directly onto the energy necessary to extract it from the earth. And even when we went off the gold standard, we saw the U.S. dollar needed to move to this petrodollar standard, right? So they had to move away from gold to black gold because black gold is the energetic lifeblood of the industrial economy. So there's always this very close relationship between money and energy. And when we look at Bitcoin through that lens, It's the first system in the world that allows us to directly monetize energy. So that's what Bitcoin mining is. It's anywhere in the world you can find marginally cheaper energy. You can put a Bitcoin miner on top of it, or Bitcoin miners, and turn it into digital gold, into a globally transactable money. So it's a way, instead of going through, say, the gold mining process that goes into these layers of intermediation before you kind of have the US dollar, which is a proxy for energy, we have this means of directly monetizing it. So we go directly from energy to a globally transactable final settlement network that is Bitcoin. Every country, every individual, every institution in the world, there's a race to the bottom now in Bitcoin in terms of energy prices. That a couple of ways to think about this. One is you could say Bitcoin is a perpetual global bounty program for unused and underused energy resources. The visual I like that Nick Carter supplied is if you imagine the Earth as a sphere, like a topographical map, with lower cost energy being lower points and higher cost energy being higher points,
right?
Bitcoin pouring a glass of water on that sphere. So it settles into the lower cost energy areas and turns it into money, basically. This is a massive demand driver. Like in the US alone, we've talked to some energy executives here. The way one guy put it that I absolutely love, he said that the entire North American energy grid was constructed and designed for one hot afternoon in August. So there's so much slack in this system where there's excess production capacity not being used, right? It's either being curtailed, which is just outright wasted, or it's being turned off. I think Bitcoin is going to be a great adjunct for energy producers going forward to monetize a lot of wasted energy. So this, I think, is an irrefutable source of demand going forward. It's anyone that has access to energy that's not currently being monetized, they're going to have this direct incentive to transmute it into digital gold.
I don't know how much time you got, and I apologize for keeping you late. I know we're going to, do you have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. How do we get to a point with Bitcoin where it's more transactional?
In terms of day-to-day transactions?
Yeah. Like we're using it as a currency.
Yeah. So we touched earlier on the custodial functions of a bank, right? So if a bank is holding Bitcoin, they can then issue their own, in a free banking society, they'd issue their own bank notes or bank tokens that were backed by Bitcoin. Here's the main premise is that Bitcoin is optimizing for survivability. That survivability, the cost of that is a ton of redundancy. Bitcoin is pure redundancy, essentially. It's every node is the whole network. With that, the cost of that redundancy is it's slow, right? It takes a while for this global network to reach consensus. The other end of that spectrum is a centralized ledger like PayPal, Venmo, the Fed. They're just updating a list once, right? Like the list changed. So they can do it lightning fast. I think you can get a dynamic of this decentralized and centralized ledgers through these bank models we talked about. But there's also a lot of promise, and it's not proven yet, but with things like the Lightning Network, which are a layer two protocol to Bitcoin that are sort of satisfying this transactional function through smart contracts. So it's a way to put Bitcoin in a software channel. The rough analogy is this. It's if you and I open a Lightning channel between one another, it's like we have an abacus between us. You've put in one Bitcoin, I put in one Bitcoin, and now we get to slide beads back and forth across that abacus. And one of us have the option to settle to Bitcoin main chain at any time. So we can pull final settlement down at any time. And the Lightning Network is just a network of those abacus connections across the world. So you can move Bitcoin at zero cost, basically instantaneously anywhere in the world. And an interesting project there too is Jack Mellor's Strike. I don't know if you've seen that yet. He did a piece from Pish recently. It's very promising. It could lead us to this world of streaming money or a money over internet protocol. But we do need a balance between that decentralized ledger that is network and the centralized ledger that would enable fast transactions.
Okay. I listened to you talking to Preston, in fact, and you were saying that what you're doing, or maybe what you were doing in 2020, was incredibly difficult because your fund was trying to trade Bitcoin and actually produce higher returns than just holding Bitcoin. You're like, this is really hard. But you guys were talking about how to reduce the volatility in Bitcoin by making sure that it's an appropriate size in your overall portfolio. And with my partners in Rebel Capitalist Pro, Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, we're always talking about how important portfolio construction is and how the average Joe never thinks about it. The only thing they think about is just this one asset. Is it going up or down in price? And I always argue that that's probably the last thing you should be thinking about. The very first thing is how is your portfolio set up to make sure that you have a mathematical edge over the long run. And so could I get your thoughts on that? Because when I'm, you know, when I'm on Twitter and on the comments of my videos sometimes, you get all these people that are 100% in gold or 100% in Bitcoin or oil or whatever it is. And they're, you know, they're buying gold on their credit card or Bitcoin on their credit card. And I'm like, guys, you're just asking for problems there. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think as a student of the market, humility is the most important virtue. Like, no matter how ideologically or emotionally bought in you are into any asset, you need to think pragmatically first.
Right.
And I agree that that pragmatism is expressed in portfolio construction. You know, there's no such thing as a too volatile asset. That's, I think that was the argument I had with Preston. Is people that say Bitcoin's too volatile, it's like, then you have too much of it in your portfolio. Like, reduce the position sizing wherever. Because there's a way to structure that portfolio. If it's 0.1% Bitcoin and 99.9% treasuries, that's your volatility profile. That's great. Yeah. It doesn't mean you have to exclude Bitcoin because it's quote unquote too volatile. So yeah, it's that's investing 101 in my mind, is that volatility and position sizing go hand in hand. And then you could also add into that diversification, right? As far as what, if these things are counter-cyclical to one another, then you can get a higher Sharpe ratio in your portfolio. Which is just risk-adjusted returns. So, yeah, always trust that the market knows more than you. So I think listen to the market, despite whatever, like, clearly I'm way down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. I'm largely allocated into Bitcoin, but I'm still listening to the market all the time. I'm never believing that I've got it figured out and over the market. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Robert, fantastic interview. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we can do it again soon. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you're doing, your YouTube channel, or anything else you got going on, where can they go?
Yeah, thanks, George. I enjoyed this a lot as well. Would love to do it again. And would love to have you on sometime, too.
Do it.
You can find most of my stuff on Twitter. My Twitter handle is my last name, which is at Breedlove22, Breedlove22. Most of the links to my stuff are there, which include my Medium page where I post most of my writing. And we just launched the YouTube channel, which is, it's a YouTube channel / podcast called the What Is Money Show. And just hoping to help educate people on the deep nature of this topic in an entertaining and understandable way. So you've been a big inspiration too. I think you're right up that alley. You're delivering, you're cutting through the jargon and the complexity to deliver some signal. And I like that. So that's what I intend to do as well.
Thank you very much. Well, Robert, enjoy the rest of your day. I'll let you go. And like I said earlier, I can't wait to do it again.
All right, thanks, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.